This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, February 5th, 2021. Thanks for joining us on your public radio station for the past 35 years, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. On today's show, how two Northwest Arkansas-based organizations are coming together to help recently settled refugees start businesses. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has that story just ahead. And that rarely used extraction tactic discussed at the state capitol this week, how exactly can a bill defeated in a committee get to a full House vote? Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek helps us learn more. After our show on Science Friday, the presidential appointee for energy justice discusses how we move to clean energy without leaving the most vulnerable behind. She says voices of the most marginalized have been censured and harmed by the existing system. And she says a paradigm shift is needed. Plus, how much threat do the virus variants pose? Science Friday, today at 1, right after this edition of Ozarks at Large. Two more dozen Arkansas deaths from COVID-19 in yesterday's report from the Arkansas Department of Health mean the state has now crossed a grim milestone. There have now been 5,009 virus deaths in the state. Nearly 2,500 new cases were included in yesterday's report, and there are now 16,533 active cases in the state. That's an increase of 459. People hospitalized with the virus decreased in the last 24 hours. 69 fewer coronavirus patients in Arkansas hospitals. There are 815 people in COVID-19 wards throughout the state. The hospitals in Benton and Washington counties are reporting 62 patients in COVID-19 units. That's far fewer than the peak during last month's surge. Still, five more patients than the previous 24 hours. The two counties reported more than 300 new cases in the most recent 24-hour testing cycle, and this region has accounted for about 18% of the positive test results in the state since the beginning of the pandemic. Arkansas Senator John Bozeman is now officially the highest-ranking Republican on the U.S. Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry. As the GOP-ranking member, Senator Bozeman will work with Senator Debbie Sabineau from Michigan, a Democrat, and the committee chair to shape the committee's agenda. Ozark Guidance in Springdale is receiving a $4 million grant to develop a certified community behavioral health clinic program during the next 2 years. The grant is awarded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. In a press release, Ozark Guidance announced the funds will be used for outreach and new service availability for underserved communities. The Arkansas Razorback women's basketball team continues to roll. Arkansas defeated Missouri 85-80 last night in Columbia. Arkansas travels to Texas A&M Sunday. And Arkansas volleyball made history last night with the program's first ever spring season win, defeating Georgia in four sets. The teams will meet again tonight in Athens. This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. Forge Community Loan Fund is partnering with Canopy Northwest Arkansas, a refugee resettlement agency. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently met Canopy's first Forge client who's establishing a business, a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And she brings us this story.
Etchemukandama is busy today. He's opening an auto sales and repair shop in Fayetteville. He legally entered the U.S. 3 years ago with his aunt and two cousins as refugees from war-torn Democratic Republic of Congo.
I came here straight from Burundi. I've been a refugee in Burundi for 16 years.
While a refugee in Burundi, Mukandama studied to be a car and large truck mechanic.
Yes, and when I came here, I started with Ozark Original Transit. Yes, fixing buses.
He repairs public transit buses.
I was thinking about doing this business, but I didn't know where to start. And when I called Canopy, telling them that I have an idea and I have some money with me, I wanted to start a business.
Called Mosi's Auto Sales and Repair, centrally located in Fayetteville Southern Business District.
And the address is 563 West MLK Junior Boulevard.
He says all used car sales are guaranteed. If you break down, he'll fix it. But to open and operate, Mukundama needed capital to purchase used cars, tools, and retail office equipment to set up inside his leased Quonset hut garage. Mukundama is the first Canopy client to apply to Forge Community Loan Fund, which lends money to small business owners and farmers in the tri-state region.
Because I don't know everything, a lot of things about the business, so I really appreciate for that help.
And that's where Khalid Ahmadzai comes in. He's Director of Economic Advancement for the nonprofit agency Canopy of Northwest Arkansas, which has resettled 195 federally vetted global refugees. After Canopy staff helped individuals and families secure affordable housing, furnishings, and food, enrolling children in public schools, Ahmadzai helps them to find work.
We have a job club, which we train them. It's a 12 lessons of A to Z, how to be prepared to enter American workforce. That's one part. Employment in general is to make sure that they are self-sufficient and they're able to pay all their bills at the end of 90 days, because that's when their assistance ends.
The Arkansas Department of Workforce Services, with several offices in Northwest Arkansas, helps Canopy refugees to secure employment. Canopy also has a network of prospective willing employers. And last March, Ahmadzai met with Neighborhood Development Center in St. Paul, Minnesota, later adapting what he learned into a 12-week entrepreneurship training program for refugees as well as immigrants in Northwest Arkansas.
A lot of our refugee community, they are self-entrepreneurs. Wherever they were in their refugee camp or in their respective home, they had a small business.
Where they were gainfully employed until their lives were disrupted by war, climate change, political or religious persecution. The entrepreneurship class aims to inspire refugees to rebuild livelihoods.
ECHA is our first one. We had our first cohort of seven individuals, and three of them started their businesses. And ECHA is the big one. The others are home-based, and ECHA's is a LLC. And we're excited to see ECHA move forward.
Ahmadzai's course teaches refugees how to develop a business plan, apply for business loans, and acquire business real estate, providing critical technical assistance.
And that's when, throughout my research, I connected with Credit Counseling of Arkansas. And then they connected me with Forge Fund. And I just had a great conversation with Philip.
Philip Adams is executive director of Forge, located in Huntsville.
Forge is a revolving loan fund that was established in 1988 to provide economic opportunity and growth to the bioregion of the Ozarks. Since then, it's grown out of its sort of birth in agriculture, providing access to farmers who are having difficulty obtaining credit from banks. That group who lacks access has grown to include rural and urban farmers and small business owners.
Currently, Forge is transacting 341 active loans valued at $6.1 million. Last year, he says, Canopy approached him to talk with their clients about lending and access to capital and learning how to close a loan.
Many of our borrowers, though, are low-income startups, so they do not have the collateral that a business going to a traditional bank might have. We have a few ways we handle that. We participate in a couple of state programs that help provide access to capital. The Arkansas Development Finance Authority has a guarantee fund. And so between Forge and the borrower, we put up a percentage of the loan into that fund. The state matches it, and it serves as a guarantee. And that is a piece of collateral where borrowers do not have that can be used to secure the loan.
Adam says Forge is a mission-driven nonprofit lender.
If all of our borrowers are successful, then we will remain successful ourselves and continue to revolve as a revolving loan fund. Part of that work means making sure that the balance of expenses and income, assets and liabilities is manageable.
Adam says Mukundama was Forge's first Canopy client. and he did all the necessary groundwork prior to meeting with the lending team.
I think his work through the entrepreneurship class and doing the working with the economic advancement through Canopy gave him a great foundation. He and I worked through a lot of his financial goals and projections to sort of balance, to make sure he had a realistic settings for these first few years. Most of the loans at Forge are financed over 5 years at a fixed interest rate. And so we try and look at that distance when we first fund a loan. It's what did you plan for these 5 years to look like?
Forge will continue to work with Etcha Mukundama to make sure he succeeds, Adam says.
We provide post-loan technical assistance throughout the life of a loan. So if anytime anyone needs anything, we're there to either provide that support ourselves or connect them with experts who can provide that support for them.
Data show, Adam says, that refugees, despite most assumptions, are low risk.
Whereas the general United States population, somewhere between 80 and 90% repay their loans, this refugee community had closer to a 98 to 99% repayment of their loans. And it, when we think through the experience of refugees prior to, say, opening a small business in the United States, when you think about perseverance, tenacity, and survivability, I think those are all great traits that we would look at when underwriting a loan in terms of, will this business be successful?
In other words, clients like Etcha Mukundama, he says, have grit. And despite a global pandemic, Adam says, Forge remains successful due to its investors who understand the mission.
The work of lending like Forge Lends is made possible through investors. Forge has money on account from individual investors, from institutional investors, charitable foundations, faith-based organizations. And we have a few loans from traditional banks who lend to us, and then we lend it out to borrowers.
Adam says, in our COVID-constricted economy, Forge is a great and altruistic investment.
If you are concerned at all about how your money makes money, which many people don't really think about, Forge is a great way to know very clearly how your money is making money.
Not to mention investing in the well-being of long-suffering global refugees now resettled in Northwest Arkansas. Canopy's offering a second entrepreneurship training session, March 16th, open to migrants, immigrants, as well as resettled refugees. And a ribbon-cutting ceremony is planned for the grand opening of Mosey's Auto Sales and Repair in the very near future. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Arkansas lawmakers are advancing a bill that would ensure the state's Medicaid program pays for behavioral and mental health telemedicine services provided after the COVID-19 pandemic ends. Members of the State House Committee on Public Health, Welfare, and Labor approved the bill by Representative Lee Johnson at a meeting yesterday. Johnson, a Republican from Greenwood, says the State Department of Human Services has been paying for telemedicine services related to mental health during the pandemic.
And in the process of that, it's been determined to be a good thing. The behavioral health providers have found this to be beneficial. The people receiving the services have found it to be beneficial. And there was a desire on the behavioral health community's part to extend past the pandemic emergency, the ability to get reimbursement for these services.
The bill was amended to exclude mental health wellness checks that are not expected to continue after the end of the coronavirus pandemic. The bill now heads to the full House for a vote. The House is approving a measure to allow private establishments in dry counties to possibly sell alcohol outdoors. The bill now moves to the Senate. The bill would grant private clubs the right to petition to have outdoor entertainment districts. In 2019, the legislature adopted a law allowing cities in wet counties to establish such districts, such as the ones approved in Fayetteville, Springdale, and Fort Smith. The Arkansas House yesterday agreed to increase the number of signatures needed to get on the Arkansas ballot as a presidential or vice presidential candidate. Current threshold is 1,000 signatures. The new requirement would be 5,000 signatures. In November, 13 people qualified to be a presidential candidate in Arkansas. And the legislature can be in session until early May. Yesterday, the House agreed 95-0 to extend the session until May 3rd if needed. This means the General Assembly can go past the constitutionally mandated close of 60 days after the beginning of the session. Yesterday's measure would also allow for an extension of business if lawmakers had to temporarily adjourn because of the pandemic. And we have more about the legislature ahead on the show. After a Stand Your Ground bill failed to get out of committee, sponsors prepared to extract the proposal with a House vote. The process explained just ahead on Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone from his Fort Smith office is Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics. The groundhog saw his shadow Tuesday, Michael, so we've got more winter to come. How are you with that?
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen my shadow. I haven't been out much in the last few days, so good for the groundhog. At least he's getting outside.
There you go. Well, we've got some other numbers to talk about. Let's talk about a story that's on talkbusiness.net right now about January building permit values down in the Fort Smith Metro and down by a significant amount?
Right. Yes, about 30%. If you remember, we ended 2020, of all things, with a record number in terms of building permit values issued in or building permit, the value of building permits issued in Fort Smith, Greenwood, and Van Buren. It was almost $265 million, which, of course, a bulk of that was Fort Smith. And that was up 9.5% compared to 2019, which still, as we've talked, when you think about that's, you know, and that's a record number of permits for the region, and it happened in a pandemic year, which no one, if anyone says they would have guessed that, they're lying. But yeah, January fell considerably. Now, part of this is I think we're going to see the impact to some extent of all of these, you know, the Fort Smith Public School District was in the midst of permitting and building out some of the largest projects in 2020. And so we're going to see some of that. But yet in January, among those three cities, there was $27.2 million in permitted activity. That was up over January, but it was 29.6% below, or it was up over December, but it was 29.6% below January 2020. And a lot of that was in a big dip in commercial activity. Van Buren saw a decrease, almost, it was 94% decrease. Greenwood had a small increase, but again, Fort Smith Metro, the city of Fort Smith is the largest part of that. Their permits were down about 21% compared to January 2020. So obviously, it's just 1 month. It's not a trend, but that is that's a big drop to start the year. So we'll see what else, you know, comes up through the year. I have had some anecdotal conversations with some commercial realtors, commercial developers, and they're not overly optimistic. A lot more will be built. In fact, there is some concern that there is already maybe an overbuilding of commercial space. Not too much has been built, but that you've had, you know, these brick and mortar stores have really taken a hit. And so you've got a lot of space open, previously built space that's open. So we'll see how 2021, it would be almost ironic that the pandemic year is the best year in history, and the year that we finally get a vaccine and things may return to normal, it's not the best year. So,
well,
hang on.
Well, yeah, and I'm wondering if, you know, you take that arbitrary border of December 31st, January 21st, where 1 year turns into the next, and what we're just seeing is perhaps something that's an inevitable consequence of 10-plus months of pandemic.
That's a good point, because you don't know how much of that activity permitted in 2020 had already been planned, and how much during that 10 months of pandemic people put stuff off that they had planned for 2021. So you could have that impact or that effect.
Other numbers from 2020, these with an up, well, we're talking 2020, not 2021, of course, but an up arrow for finances. And the Sebastian County sales tax in 2020 was up, and this kind of goes with that idea that just doesn't make sense on the surface.
No, it doesn't make sense. I mean, on the surface, and remember back in March and April when the pandemic first hit and everything shut down, the city of Fort Smith, city administrator Carl Gefkin, you know, they immediately implemented a 10% across the board cut in all departments. They anticipated up to a 22% reduction in sales tax revenue for the year. Well, we ended up the year, the city's portion of the Sebastian County 1 cent sales tax was up 5.7%. And again, that's important because that helps fund a lot of the city's general fund for police, fire services, and other critical services. So it's a, and it's also obviously a barometer of economic activity. So it was up 5.7%. It was up 5.5% over the city's budget estimate. Now, what Mr. Gefkin and others didn't know in March and April was that, you know, that large federal stimulus package that was approved.
Right.
And you talk to just about any economist and they will tell you that those, not only the stimulus checks, but the PPE, they're the PPP program, the extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits, that that held the consumer up. And so it'll be interesting to see what economists, what the deep dive will look like when economists really have time to look at the economy and consumer spending in the past 10 months. But right now, the conventional wisdom is that, you know, consumers spent money, you know, they weren't traveling. So the money that they weren't spending on travel and they weren't going out to eat quite a bit, but they were online shopping, and those sales taxes now come back to communities, and they were still spending. They were just shifting their spending. And some of that shift has helped municipalities and counties in Arkansas and all over the country. So I think Fort Smith saw that, fortunately. And we'll see. And I, you know, we've got a couple of city directors who say, well, it's a reflection that the Fort Smith economy is so healthy. Well, I hope they're correct. I think there are other factors at play. I think the Fort Smith economy is not as healthy as maybe some other metro areas, especially in terms of employment gains when you compare those to other areas. But it's definitely the, if I was a city administrator and the city board, I would definitely be grateful. I think they dodged a big bullet because they, a 20% cut in, or 20% loss in tax revenue could have resulted in some very tough decisions.
Hey, speaking of decisions, let's revisit Fiona Hills Golf Club. Fiona Hills Golf Club, because I don't know where we are with this. You and I talked about it. It seemed like in the last few months of 2020, there were plans. The plans got scuttled. There were ideas. Where are we?
Yeah, I'm going to start calling it the Fiona Hills Zombie Club because it just keeps coming back. But no, the city of Fort, there, David Millay, who owns the former club and the golf course, is essentially trying to sell portions of the fairways and the greens and all that to adjacent homeowners who live, well, obviously on the course. And so they're trying to replat some of that property. Well, the Planning Commission approved replatting of some of the property unanimously, but the Fort Smith Board has this past Tuesday decided to table, because they have to approve that.
Right.
Decided to table it for 90 days. They still, there's enough on the board who believe that it's in the better interest of the city for Fiona Hills to open back up as a golf club and a course, to keep that course active, because City Director Kevin Settle said once you sell off a part of one of the fairways, you just pretty much kill the project. Danny Aldridge, who is a Sebastian County Quorum Court member and who lives up there and is a former club member, has said, you know, he wants to go back and try and work with David Millay to somehow buy the property or put it back to its use. Now, I wouldn't hold out hope. I mean, it would be, maybe it'd be nice if Aldridge is successful, but this would be the third, maybe fourth attempt to try to get Mr. Millay off the dime, so to speak. He has been difficult, it's not the right word, but he's just been a tough negotiator and has made it clear in a letter to some of the former club members and to some homeowners on the course that golf clubs don't make money anymore. And if he sold it to someone to try to make money or to get it going, it would just fail again and they'd lose their money. So he's been pretty negative about the outlook for the golf club and has said the only, his only real option is to just sell, start selling it off piece by piece. Now, that doesn't answer And Mr. Millay doesn't talk to the media. In fact, he likes to hang up on the media. Hasn't talked about what he would do with the club itself, the building, but he is trying to sell parts of the golf course. So we have a 90-day delay on this. Kyle, we'll see. I mean, I certainly wouldn't be shining up the golf shoes or getting the golf clubs ready, but we'll see.
Well, you know, we never thought Arkansas and Arkansas State would play each other in football.
Wow.
And that's going to happen, apparently.
Yep. Well, it's going to happen in 2025. I just think that's – they might as well said 2045. I mean, that's, to me, is so far off.
Yeah, like you said, we're some time away, but at least on paper it's going to happen now.
I'm not a big fan of War Memorial, the stadium itself, but, I mean, after you've been to Donald W. Reynolds, War Memorial just – It's not the same experience, but hell, I'd even be willing to go down there to watch that game.
Right. You can read about all of this, including the Arkansas-Arkansas State announcement at talkbusiness.net. Michael, good to talk with you. We'll visit again next Friday.
All right. Stay warm, sir.
Right. Thanks.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum on the Square in downtown Bentonville. Scheduled visits are welcomed daily from noon to 6 p.m. WalmartMuseum.com to reserve your visit or for more information. The Kiva NWA Hub is a local, community-based lending program and a branch of Kiva US. This program expands access to microloans, which help entrepreneurs in Northwest Arkansas develop and thrive. These non-conventional loans are for disadvantaged area business owners and sole proprietors. Applicants and lenders interested in supporting area business borrowers can learn more at kiva-nwa.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Stand Your Ground bill, sponsored by Arkansas Republican Senator Bob Ballinger and Republican Representative Aaron Pinkleton, has been in the news a lot this week. While the bill passed overwhelmingly in the Senate last month, this week it failed to get the necessary votes in the House Judiciary Committee to move on to a vote in the full chamber. But as Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek tells us, just because the bill didn't get passed right away doesn't mean it's been defeated.
Those who oppose Senate Bill 24, the so-called Stand Your Ground bill, took a moment to celebrate Tuesday after the legislation failed in committee. But they followed it up with a reminder that it can still become a law. That's because there are a lot of steps between the time a bill is filed and the time its fate is decided. Janine Perry, a professor of political science at the University of Arkansas, describes the process this way.
It's kind of like a game of chutes and ladders. You got to go through both chambers. The proposal has to go through both chambers in exactly the same form. The way that that happens is usually through committees and subcommittees. There are opportunities for hearings and amendments. And then, if it's really going to pass, right, it goes through all of those steps and it comes out the other side, usually just a simple majority of each chamber, and then it can get sent to the executive.
But Perry says in this case, the game of chutes and ladders has a lot more chutes than it does ladders. That is to say, there are a lot of ways for a bill to fail.
The way we think about it in the legislative world is often that ideas incubate for a long time. And then when they find their moment, or we reach a different consensus, or we get different legislators, maybe in a different environment, it will finally emerge. But another way to think of it is that a powerful leader or group of leaders can just leave things bottled up in committee indefinitely. So that's definitely one of the primary stopping points. Indeed, the vast majority of legislation doesn't get out of committee.
Which is what happened earlier this week. Following more than 3 hours of testimony and debate, SB 24 didn't get enough votes to get out of the House Judiciary Committee. Here is the bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Aaron Pilkington, introducing the bill on the floor.
For the last 2 years, myself and Senator Ballinger worked to create a piece of legislation that would bring Arkansas's self-defense laws in line with over 30 other states. However, since 2019, this legislation has been dogged by misrepresentation and lies. However, what is clear is a majority of voters in Arkansas see through this and want this piece of legislation. For instance, in the 2020 election, many of my colleagues were attacked for supporting Stand Your Ground legislation, yet many of them won their own race. While the lone Republican who voted against Stand Your Ground legislation went on to lose his seat.
The bill would end the duty to retreat if the person using deadly force is lawfully present, had reasonable belief they were being threatened, they were not engaged in criminal or gang activity, and they are not a felon or the initial aggressor. One person at Tuesday's committee hearing spoke in favor of the bill, while dozens of others, including educators, criminal defense attorneys, doctors, and community organizers, urged lawmakers to vote against it.
This bill recognizes the rights of free Americans to not have to give up their rights. That's just kind of a basic principle that I think we should recognize in law.
Arkansas's existing self-defense laws already sufficiently give people the right to protect themselves, their property, and others when necessary.
I come to you today with a heavy heart. How many tragedies like Trayvon Martin and others must our country endure before we retreat from allowing armed citizens to shoot and kill?
Do you believe that we have a contingent of people in our state that are white racist supremacists? Do you believe that? Do you believe that this bill, if it's passed, they will take that? They're the ones watching this debate. They're the ones waiting to see what's going to happen with this bill because it will just empower them.
This bill allows individuals to be jury, judge, jury, and executioner with little to no consequence for their actions.
The bill also faced some opposition from supporters of gun rights, who argued the bill would muddy Arkansas's existing self-defense laws and wondered whether any changes were necessary. SB 24 then ended up failing on a voice vote. Professor Janine Perry says that's despite having the apparent support of the majority party after passing through the Senate last month.
And it's not just a majority party in Arkansas, right? It's a super majority party, one of the most lopsided legislatures in the country in terms of its partisan ratios. So that part was, I think, a little surprising to some people, but there's some scholarship to suggest that perhaps it shouldn't have been surprising. But when you have a supermajority of that, they tend to show signs of of friction and of cracking, right? You get particular bands and factions inside that supermajority.
Perry says the voice vote also allows lawmakers to avoid having to go on the record as being for or against a bill.
Many of them, they might not want to express reservations, they might have reservations. And so committee is often where sort of quietly something that's publicly necessary for them to support, but privately not something that they think is a good policy to advance. It's a place where it can just get quietly smothered.
But quietly is not how this bill is going. Perry and lawmakers on both sides of the debate say it's far from dead. At one point, SB 24's lead sponsors suggested supporters of the bill would move to extract it from committee to go straight to the House floor on a two-thirds vote. There are 100 members in the House, 77 are Republicans, and 25 are Democrats. Perry says extraction is an unusual maneuver that came into being about 100 years ago in response to a particularly autocratic Speaker of the House, a Republican from Illinois named Joe Cannon.
Then you can use that maneuver to seriously pry a bill out of committee that's been stuck there because of a leader or because of dynamics inside the group, et cetera. So that's the mechanism we've heard some talk about. It looked like yesterday it was an inevitable thing, but now it looks like they're in conversation, right? They being the majority party and its various factions.
Perry says extraction is rarely used because it indicates there's division in the party, so members don't turn to it too often. That kind of move also has a low rate of success. But the bill can just be brought back before the committee one more time following revisions or successful conversations with fellow lawmakers, which is the path both of SB 24's main sponsors have indicated they are planning to take instead.
I think this whole thing is also a really interesting example of a broader phenomenon we've been noting in state legislatures for the last decade or so, which is that, you know, we have red states and blue states, and the vast majority of states right now aren't just red states, but they're what we call trifectas, or they're Republican trifectas.
Which means a state has a Republican governor as well as a Republican majority in the House and Senate.
One of the things that's really interesting about that is those states, the people who are elected in those states, are moving to the right, even of their constituents. and the people in the blue states, the ones that remain, are moving even to the left of their constituents.
Perry says because of this polarization, more lawmakers are proposing extreme legislation that may not reflect what the majority of a state's residents actually want. Perry is also the director of the Arkansas Poll. And in the latest survey conducted in 2020, 51% of respondents said they'd rather not see any changes to existing gun laws.
You know, what we kind of call these ideological points of the average state level official, left and right, are markedly different at this point than the average ideological point of the electorate.
There's a chance Senate Bill 24 could be brought up in committee a second time as early as next week. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
Senator Ballinger and Representative Pilkington say they've worked with prosecutors, sheriffs, and police chiefs to address some of the concerns that led those groups to oppose the 2019 Stand Your Ground proposal. This time around, those groups are choosing to remain neutral on Senate Bill 24. With more people working from home and more businesses relying on technology, digital sector jobs are increasingly in demand. So, a national nonprofit is equipping workers in Northwest Arkansas with the tech skills they need for those jobs. They're doing this through coding boot camps. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports.
If the past year has taught job seekers anything, it's that technology is increasingly integral to nearly every industry. And that means that more companies are looking for employees who know how to navigate the digital world.
We are helping move people into high-wage and stable careers. And at the same time, these careers are in very high demand across the country and in Northwest Arkansas, and companies are experiencing a shortage of tech talent. So we're filling those roles at the same time.
That's Leah Freeman. She's the public relations director for LaunchCode, a St. Louis-based nonprofit that provides free coding courses to aspiring computer programmers. The organization launched its first Northwest Arkansas-based course in October. The introductory course is an intensive 20-week program designed to train students with skills they need to seek an apprenticeship and, ultimately, a career in technology. The program is backed by the Walton Family Foundation and the Arkansas Center for Data Science.
We kind of looked at the region and looked at how many companies are in the region versus how much traditional computer science technologists are being produced by local colleges. And we saw there absolutely was an imbalance of those two things. So our program was needed in the region.
Freeman says there are around 800 to 1,000 open computing jobs in the state of Arkansas right now, with an average salary coming in at more than $72,000, significantly higher than the statewide average. And while the coronavirus pandemic has sparked record unemployment, the demand for jobs in the digital sector has actually risen, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Companies have realized that with human capital being remote, that they can turn some of these tasks into automated tasks. So the more people that gain digital skills, the more jobs that will be open for them now and in the future.
And that's what's driving many of LaunchCode's 120 Northwest Arkansas students to take part in the program. Students like Christina Petrosky.
Like, I know I have the ability to get a better job than what I was doing, but I didn't have anything really to quantify that as far as a resume goes. Basically, I realized in this market that's flooded with job seekers that I'm going to have a hard skill that I can say, I can do this specific thing.
Petrosky, who lives in Lowell, worked as an import order manager for a hat manufacturing company until March of 2020, when she says she lost her job because of the COVID-19 pandemic, which she says was the driving force behind her applying to LaunchCode.
I saw the Facebook ad and just like, okay, this looks like a sign. This looks like a good road to take. So I took it.
Someone else who saw that Facebook ad was Jason Oliver, a Fayetteville-based pizza delivery man. Oliver said he had his hours cut to part-time because of the pandemic.
I have to say that with the pandemic, it put me in a place where I was more receptive to maybe trying something new and just putting my heart and soul into something and just going like, this is the time, this is the chance.
Both Petrosky and Oliver say they had some previous experience with computer programming, but course instructor James Quick says that's not the case for most of his students.
It's a steep learning curve. So we don't have any expectations for people coming in at all. There is, I think they fill out in their application, they have to do like a kind of a logic problem. It's not programming at all. It's just kind of like how you think, how you critically think, that sort of thing. So no, we don't have any expectations around programming experience or even really being very aware of what programming actually looks like.
The Launch Code course focuses on what it calls upskilling, that's honing in on people already in the workforce, but who are unfamiliar with technology that employers need to function. This introductory course focuses on JavaScript, which Quick says is ubiquitous for web development in most industries. And he says this coding boot camp can go a long way in making students more desirable job candidates.
In a lot of ways, they're going to walk away with much more practical experience than what I did in college. Things like working with source control and Git and GitHub and working with the terminal and actually building a web application. Those are things that they're going to have experience with that I didn't have coming out of my degree.
And Petrosky says she's hoping to start her programming career at the end of the course and find stable work.
It's only becoming more essential as our society becomes more and more tech-oriented and tech-driven. So seeing those things that are essential, and I wouldn't say necessarily pandemic-proof, but less likely to be cut in the event of some sort of disaster or economic downturn.
Oliver agrees that understanding technology and coding is becoming more essential. But he says, for him, the program was never about a job. He says he's always been interested in computer programming, but just never had the tools or professional guidance to do it.
Just even in this small community, you know, just helping people meet up with similar interests, you know, just documenting things that are cool around town for future generations. Just there's all the code is just a tool to help you do things easier. And I think that was part of what clicked for me a long time ago. It doesn't take, like, that's why I just do think that these things like Launch Code are just so amazing, is because you don't have to get a job for this to empower you so much on a personal level.
And according to Leah Freeman, that sense of community is what helps make Launch Code students hone in on their new skills and become more successful.
You know, we have courses running throughout the country right now. And something that we've heard at graduation recently is, I feel like I know these people even though I've never met them, because everyone is going through the same challenge together and they really lean on each other to solve problems or when they're frustrated. It's a really hard course. It's not easy to learn computer programming, and you know, you definitely need that added support. So we have just found creative ways to build that even though they're at home.
The Northwest Arkansas Launch Code course will conclude in June. This week, the company opened a landing page, launchcode.org/Arkansas, so that potential employers can recruit students from the program. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
You can hear stories like that one from Daniel Carruth every Monday through Friday at noon and 7 p.m. on Ozarks at Large. But we know you can't always be with us at those times. That's why we make The Daily Show available as a free podcast. You can subscribe through any of the major podcast distributors. You can also find past shows, stories, and interviews at ozarksatlarge.com.
In the background, you hear Corey Christiansen, a great jazz guitarist, and I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz here on KUAF. We'll hear more from Corey, as well as Hammond B3 organist Pat Bianchi, pianist Alfredo Rodriguez, the Jeff Hamilton Trio, Pat Metheny, and much more. That's Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday here on KUAF.
We're closing a week of programs today, but we're already looking forward to next week. On Monday's Ozarks at Large, Antoinette Grajeda gives us a report about the new exhibit at Crystal Bridges Museum of Art, Crafting America. That's on Monday's show at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Butterfield Trail Village, Northwest Arkansas's retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being. Amenities and living options from apartments to village homes, plus on-site fitness facilities are available. ButterfieldTrailVillage.org for information.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone this week from her office in Bella Vista is Becca Martin Brown, who is the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Becca, welcome back to the show.
And is bouncing up and down in my desk chair because we have not one, not two, not three, four opportunities for theater this weekend.
I would dare say that's almost too many to do in one weekend, but let's see if we can try.
I would dare say, but I am so thrilled to have theater back. I'd give it a good run. All and right. A couple of them you can see online.
Okay.
Okay, live and in person, Arkansas Public Theater in Rogers has opened its doors for the first time since Newsies last February.
Ooh, wow.
The show is called Buyer and Seller, spelled seller like a basement. A one-man show makes it nice and safe for the actor and everybody else. And it's a really interesting script. Barbara Streisand wrote a book about her passion for design. And in this book, this part's real, in this book she talked about the shopping street that she built in her basement, which was made up of her collectibles, but set in stores. Okay, the premise of the script is, what if she hired somebody to be a clerk down there? Amazing show. Jacob Andrews is the one actor who also plays like six other roles, including Streisand, and he's amazing. And they're doing all the things to keep you safe, masks and distance seating and all of that stuff. 8 o'clock today and tomorrow, 2 o'clock Sunday, and again Thursday through next Sunday. It's just two weekends. Tickets start at $15. You've got to have a reservation because they're only seating 124 patrons maximum.
Gotcha.
631-8988 or arkansaspublictheater.org. If you want to see more live theater, hop in the car and run up the road to Springfield, because Springfield Little Theater is doing The Sound of Music.
Now, this is not a one-person show.
No, but what they did, they cut the cast down to just speaking parts. And there's no live orchestra. They have the orchestration that came with the script.
I gotcha.
Then they called in all of the people who auditioned and created a chorus. And the chorus recorded all of the places in the show that need more voices. Jennifer Armstrong Shaver is playing the Mother Abbess, and you know her in Northwest Arkansas as Miss Hannigan in the Arkansas Public Theater production of Annie a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And as Aunt March in the Pilot Arts production of Little Women. And this one comes with two options. You can go to the beautiful Landers Theater in Springfield and see it live. 7:30 today, 2 and 7:30 tomorrow, 2 on Sunday, and again, February 11th through 14th. Or you can stream it. And when they say stream it, they mean you get to see that night's performance. You can find out more at Springfield Little Theater with an RE.org. And then there's Schoolgirls or the African Mean Girls Play, which is wrapping up at Theater Squared and has gotten some really great reviews. Tickets are $20 to $35, $20 for one person, $35 for a family at theater2.org. And then the University of Arkansas is doing its Archetype New Works Festival online. And it's always been a little festival done live, but they missed last year because of the pandemic. So this year they decided we're going to take this online. And it's going to be a different experience for the playwrights because this is works in progress, and the playwrights need to be there to watch how the audiences react. They're working on ways to get audience reaction, but in the meantime, you can still see three of the shows. 2084, which is by John Walsh, who is the head of the playwriting program.
And wickedly talented, by the way.
7 o'clock today and tomorrow, and again the 12th and 13th. We're All Soldiers in a Strange War by Brandon Bessis at 7:30 tonight. Mm-hmm. And Sisters by Lauren Farabee, who has done some super cool stuff, at 7:30 tomorrow. So you can go on the University Theater website and sign up to do that. And then there's two other things that I want you to make sure you do. Rogers Historical Museum has a Valentine's Day exhibit. It's called Valentine's Flattery and Insults.
Okay, all right.
It's a traveling exhibit organized by Blair O'Murrow Exhibitions of Kansas City. And it looks at not only the beautiful handmade cards from the 19th and early 20th centuries, but also the ones that are political commentary or commentary on life at the time.
And you can walk in and see this, right?
You can walk in and see this. Hours are 10 to 4, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. It's in the main building of the Rogers Historical Museum, and it's free. There's a new exhibit at Brews in Eureka Springs called Twisted Beaded Braided, and it's fiber arts. Weaving and macrame and felting and quilting and all of that. And includes people like Eleanor Lux, who was declared an Arkansas Living Treasure a couple of years ago. One of the artists works in velvet tapestries embellished with ribbons and feathers and braid and seed beads and rhinestones. Her name is Kathy Martone, and I think she's my sister by another mother.
I gotcha.
It's a fun show. It's up until March 3rd at Brews. They say come, if you can, during the week,
mm-hmm.
because it's less busy, but they're not doing like an opening reception or anything.
When you say during the week, you mean Monday through Friday?
Right.
Okay.
It's free, or you can go to Brews Online Art Exhibition on Facebook and see the whole thing that way.
All right. Becca Martin-Brown is the features editor with the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. She joins us almost every Friday. Becca, thanks for the updates. We'll talk to you again next week.
Happy to do it. See you then.
Mike Nichols won Academy, Emmy, Grammy, and Tony Awards, but also made some clunkers.
Dave the Dolphin was not a movie that was incredibly close to Mike's heart. He would refer to it later in life disparagingly as the fish movie.
Mark Harris has a new biography of the director, not the dolphin. Those stories and all the news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition Saturday, tomorrow morning from 7 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Paris. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Timothy Dennis produced today's show at his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Contributors to our program today included Daniel Carruth, Jacqueline Froelich, and Zuzanna Sitek. Additional content today provided by our friends at KUAR Public Radio in Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Our continued Friday thank yous extended to Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics and Becca Martin-Brown, who is the features editor with the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Our theme, titled First Hurrah, is written and performed by Daryl Sean. We're back with you Sunday morning at 9 for the next edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large, and then we'll be back Monday at noon and 7 to start a brand new week of daily editions of Ozarks at Large. You can always find out more about us and listen to past shows, individual stories and interviews at ozarksatlarge.com. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.